Welcome to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA, sponsored by Green Line Service Corp. Over the next hour, you'll be introduced to business and local leaders impacting our community. Text your comments or questions directly to the studio at 540-371-5756. Now, the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
The Cultural Quilt Series continues in Fredericksburg this week. The topic will be France, and that's what we're going to talk about this morning. Dr. Craig Vasey is here this morning, along with Dr. Brooke DeLauro here to talk about it. They're involved with the program on Thursday night at the Central Rappahannock Regional Library. Good morning to both of you. Thanks for
Good morning.
And coming in this morning.
Thanks for having us.
We were talking earlier that I'm with two people who don't get up, who don't generally get up early, and I don't understand you people. This is morning. We get up.
Feeling is mutual, right?
That's right.
It's great to have you both here. You both have a connection to France, and that's what we'll get into this morning. How did you get, Dr. DeLauro? I'll start off with you. How did you get interested in France and the culture and things?
So my background is probably fairly unique in that I started French in first grade. So I grew up in Baltimore, went to a private all-girls school, and French was required from first to eighth grade.
Really?
Then I continued with it, not discouraged as many were, and I think even more so today sometimes, but my parents were German professors. So they said, you know, they encouraged the language learning, and we traveled a lot in Europe. I have seen more of Europe than of the U.S. probably because I followed them on conferences and things like that. Then I just continued in college and thought I would go back to that school and teach French. And once I got to third year of college, I thought, wait, but there's so much more I could learn, and decided to pursue a PhD. And then came straight from that to Mary Wash, and this is the end of my 20th year at Mary Wash.
Wow! Well, congratulations.
Thanks.
So, is there a part of France that is a favorite for you?
Wow. I think Paris probably is my favorite. I'm a city person to begin with, okay. And that's the place I've spent the most time. So I did sort of your typical junior semester abroad in college in Paris. In grad school, part of my program included a year as a pensionnaire étrangère, so a foreign exchange student at the École Normale Supérieure, which was one of the sort of prestigious schools for the humanities in Paris. So we got to study there for a year and mostly wrote our dissertations. But I like to say that that's the only place, and it's true, that I do not have, or that I do rather have a sense of direction, because my sense of direction is terrible. But I, having been lived there,
yeah,
right, without GPS,
right,
without cell phones, I had to rely, you know, actually pay attention to what I was doing. So that's the one place I can go and know where I'm going and never get lost. But I have developed a fondness for Aix-en-Provence, which is at where I now do my study abroad program, and it's a very different vibe, much smaller down in the south.
Okay.
But I think there, you know, as anywhere in the world, there's advantages to both types of places. But there's so many options. But I think those are where my two fondnesses lie these days, at least.
Craig, how about you? Where does your interest in France come from?
From philosophy. When I was an undergraduate studying philosophy, I got particularly interested in existentialism and phenomenology, which are schools of philosophy that were were certainly well represented by French philosophers like Sartre, Jean-Paul Sartre. And when I was an undergraduate, I decided I wanted to go to Paris to do graduate studies, because there were so many French philosophers who were teaching and living,
right,
in Paris at the
mm-hmm.
time. Michel Foucault, Jacques Derrida, Sartre was still alive, Emmanuel Levinas. So actually I just decided in my third year of college that I wanted to learn French so I could go to Paris for graduate school. And that's what I did. I actually spent 2 years studying very intensely, and my professor was very skeptical. He said, "You're never going to – that's not going to happen." But I did, and when I was 20 years old, I went to Paris. When I finished college at 20 – I was 20, and I went to Paris in 1976, and I stayed for 3 years. And, living in Paris and studying, I wrote a master's degree there, master's dissertation, and I wrote a PhD. And then I came back to the United States. But by then, of course, I was fluent.
Yeah.
I taught French at as a graduate student at Brown University when I was pursuing an American PhD. And the reason I did the American PhD was because I knew I'd never get a job in America
with a French
PhD.
That makes sense.
I mean, it was an extra, but without a bona fide, serious American PhD, I wasn't in the network that was going to get me serious consideration for an academic job at the university level. But that's where I started out with French, was that way. And then I've just held on to it. And I've taught French at Brown when I was a grad student. And I taught French at a couple of other colleges when I was getting started afterwards, before I finally got a full-time position as a philosophy professor. And then while I was at Mary Washington, I even taught three or four times. I taught a seminar in French on French philosophy. I found four or five students who had enough French that they wanted to do that, and they were philosophy majors. And so we read Descartes and Sartre and Foucault in French, and did all the work in French. So I've kept it up for 50 years.
So did I understand you right that you started learning French at about 18, you were about 18?
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Wow, because you always hear that when you get to, as you get older, you can't do that. So I understand why a professor said you're not going to do it.
And I tuned into French much, but I was already taking German. I was in my second year of German, and when I got this idea that, oh, I should go to Paris, for graduate school, and I began French. So it was really, I definitely would have been 18 because I started at 16. Yeah. I started at 16 when I was in college.
Interesting. We get to a break. I've got some questions about just learning languages, and then we'll jump into Thursday. I could talk about languages with both of you the whole time. We do have a Thursday night program to talk about, too. We'll get to that when we as we go along this morning. The Cultural Quilt Series continues Thursday night at the Downtown Library in France is the theme, and that's our focus this morning on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
This is Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA, sponsored by Green Line Service Corp. You can access all episodes of Town Talk online at newstalk1230.net or on your favorite podcast streaming platform. Now, back to your host, Ted Schubel.
Dr. Brooke DeLauro is here along with Dr. Craig Vasey here this morning as the Cultural Quilt Series goes and talks about France this week, 6:30 on Thursday night at the Downtown Library is the program. We're going to get into that. But as you two are talking just about languages, and I am so sorry that in growing up I never learned a language, and I just feel left out as so many people, even in this community, can speak a second language. How important is it to learn a language, and especially learn it young? I mean, Craig, to me, you are just what you did was incredible. Because you always hear that later in life, it's harder to it's harder to learn. How important is it though to be able to be fluent in another language?
Well, it's fun. It's really fun. Once you realize that you don't actually think in a language, you don't have to when you don't have to think about how to say what you want to say. That's how it is in English. When you speak in English, you don't think of it how to say what you're going to say. You just say it.
Right.
And when you achieve that level in another language, it's just kind of a remarkable experience. It's a real insight. But also the fact that you then take for granted the way that you say things in another language that are just not the way you say them in your native language is a lot of fun too.
Yeah.
I mean, you have a lot of insight into ideas, I guess, is what I want to say.
Yeah, I think there are even sort of small aspects of the language beyond the nitty-gritty, grammar, et cetera, that tell you a lot about the culture. I'm seeing if I can think of an example. So, for example, in French, say something sort of, oh, it's good, not anything too enthusiastic, you say it's not bad. All the sort of what in English are neutral responses, let's say positive but not too positive, are all negative expressions in French. And that shows sort of this underlying a little bit of sort of sarcasm, cynicism that underlies French culture, but that's, you know, subtlety that's built into the language. I mean, I always like to joke that the word for lonely and single and alone are all the same in France, right? This culture that has a reputation for being built on love and relationships,
yeah.
Right? So if you're single, you are lonely. It's literally the same word, right? Then so these kind of things are really fascinating when you get deep dive into a language.
Well, in your case, you learned English and French almost simultaneously.
Yeah, so I certainly wasn't fluent at that young age. We were still, you know, just conjugating verbs in fourth grade, which is young, but I think a lot of it was culture, right? So, I mean, I think we memorized a Victor Hugo poem in third grade, right? I mean, just little thing, but that intertwining of language and culture is something that I think is critical to engage students, right? We were saying, you know, it takes a lot of work, we were talking about in the break, and sometimes students aren't ready, prepared for the amount of work it takes, but you have to find, I think, the cultural hook is really the way to get them interested. Mm-hmm. And once you can find that entree, then they feel like it's something that's not too daunting and they might find fun, right, as Craig had said, or get something out of.
Yeah, no, to say it's fun, that's a great response, and should get people. There are so many options of people, you know, there are online ways that people can learn, and there are different ways, but I guess like you two have said, you got to want to do it.
Yes.
And you've got to put in the time.
Well, when we went to France, the Sister City Association celebrated its 45th anniversary in 2025. And we went, 20 people from Fredericksburg went to Fréjus back in September. And I had a ball because I was just speaking French. I spoke French for 2 weeks. It was just great. I mean, I, right. I never get a chance to speak French
right.
like that. And the people the people I'm talking with, the French people, were delighted because most people from the Sister City Association
don't really speak
French very much. They know a little bit. But they rely on their hosts to speak English, enough English to get by. And I was having such a good time just speaking French all the time. It was just good.
You've been here before. We've talked in about the Sister City program that Fredericksburg has, and just how unique the Fredericksburg has so many Sister City connections.
Yeah.
And this whole lecture series this spring and summer is just another way to bring out some of the cultural things and to bring local people like yourselves to be able to step forward in areas where you have some expertise to be able to lead a talk.
Yeah, it was a great idea that Catherine Willis and Scott Walker got brought this idea to me. They told me about it, that they wanted to do something for the 250th anniversary that had to do with cultural influences on foreign cultural influences on American character, American identity and culture. And so we really want to give credit to them, especially Catherine Wills. She does so much work for the Sister City Associations.
Brooke, your topic on Thursday, and we'll get into this as we go along this morning more into. But you're going to talk about food.
Yeah. So I think, you know, French cuisine is known around the world.
Right.
It has a certain cachet. What is it? Julia Child once famously said, "It's a." National sport, right? French cooking is a national sport. And for centuries, really, cooking à la française in the French style has been associated with refinement, status, things like that, right? But it occurred to me that that's sort of the outer-facing picture for the world to see. But there's also the way that the French perceive food, and that's something different. So it's the culinary tradition combines, you know, history and artistry and technique and cultural identity, but it also changes the way that the French view food, so that, you know, they beyond the changes that it's made to restaurants, right, the influence on fine dining and developing the hierarchy in the kitchen and things like that, and foundational techniques like the basic sauces and braising and things like that. It also has just an influence on people because it's the way that the French socialize, right, around the table, right? So it's the everyday rituals matter too. It's they reinforce community ties, markets, even your everyone has a relationship with their boulanger, their bread, you know, the person at the local bakery, and the whoever sells the vegetables, they have a particular vendor for particular vegetables at the market, and so there's a social aspect to it. And I think I was really intrigued by by the fact that in 2010 UNESCO granted recognized the gastronomic meal of France as part of the world's intangible cultural heritage. So we're more familiar with UNESCO's sort of sites, cultural sites, right? But they have this list of intangible cultural heritages that includes things like the Argentine tango, for example. But they made a point of saying it's not about specific dishes, but about the ritual of eating together, right? So the social performance surrounding food, that's what they were recognizing. I think sort of that's the part that maybe I want to work up to on Thursday, is that, that's the part that people know less well. Everyone knows all the terms and you know, souffle and sous vide and julienne and mise en place, all these things are used internationally. But sort of the importance of cuisine in French culture and to the French is kind of what I want to work towards.
Interesting. Craig, you're talking about the Statue of Liberty.
Yeah. Well, you know, there is no more well-recognized and I think loved symbol of America than I think the Statue of Liberty. I mean, it's just universal. People all over the world, people know the Statue of Liberty, that image. And it's French in origin. I'm not even sure if all Americans know that, but it's French in origin. It was a gift. We talk about it as a gift that France, from France to America. And I think that's one of the things that's interesting to look into a little bit, because this statue was... Well, the idea began. The idea came out of the Civil War, came out of the American Civil War. This French sculptor, Bartholdi, got the idea after the end of slavery, of wanting to build. He had this ambition. He wanted to build the biggest statue in the world. To build the biggest statue in the world, and he wasn't originally thinking about doing it for America. He originally proposed the idea to Egypt because the Suez Canal had just been completed, and the Suez Canal connected the Mediterranean to the, you know, to the Eastern world. So this 120 mile long canal, absolutely amazing. And he proposed to Egypt that he would build a lighthouse statue of a woman holding a torch. And it would be in honor of the Suez Canal and progress. And Egypt turned him down.
Really? Because you could see it. That makes total sense. And you think about the pyramids, and you just think about a lot of things that would fit.
Right. And so this is 1869, I think, if I recall correctly. And Egypt turned him down. And so he's trying to think of someplace else where he can build this statue, because his ambition was to build the biggest statue in the world. It wasn't originally to build what we think of as the symbol of America.
Right.
So it takes him a few years to figure that out. But then he decides, well, he'll propose it to New York. And what he's trying to do too is he's remembering that there is in the ancient world there was the Colossus of Rhodes, this huge statue which was built. Well, we don't know what it looked like exactly, because of course there's no photographs of it. There's only sketches and drawings and paintings of what people said. There's myths about it. That's it. But apparently it one of the myths is that it stood over. The two legs of the statue, it's a statue of Helios, of the sun god, one leg on this side of the on a piece of land, and the other on the other piece of land, and the ships go under the statue. Yeah. And it apparently came down in 625, but it was destroyed by an earthquake, something like that. So anyway, that's the idea he had, and he wanted to build a new Colossus. And of course, that's the name... I don't know if people even know that, but Emma Lazarus's poem is called The New Colossus, the one that says, give me your tired, your poor.
Yeah,
you know,
okay.
It's called The New Colossus. So that was very much on Bartholdi's mind that he was trying to reproduce, and this was going to be even bigger. I think the original one was 105 feet tall, and his is 150 feet tall. Mm-hmm. So he wanted to build the biggest statue in the world. But anyway, I just thought, you know, I know there's stuff about the Statue of Liberty that I don't know. And and that means that other people don't know it too. And it's this French gift to the United States. It's the symbol of America. It's the symbol of liberty. This intrigued me. I just wanted to learn more about it. And so I learned, like, that was one of the most fascinating things I learned about it, was that the fact that it wasn't conceptualized as a gift to the United States to celebrate liberty. That was plan B.
I've already learned. Yeah, I have never heard that story. It is the Cultural Quilt series. It is continues this Thursday night, 6:30 at the Downtown Library. France is the topic, and a couple of the presenters here this morning, Dr. Brooke DeLauro and Dr. Craig Vasey is here this morning to talk about what they are talking about on Thursday night, dealing with France. We'll continue on News Talk 1230 WFVA. It is 8:30.
From the Fredericksburg FreePress.com studios, this is News Talk 1230 WFVA Fredericksburg, a Centennial Broadcasting Station. Welcome back to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA, sponsored by Green Line Service Corp. You can weigh in about today's topic on Facebook at WFVA 1230 and by text at 540-371-5756. Here's your host, Ted Schubel.
The Cultural Quilt Series, our focus this morning. Dr. Craig Vasey is here. Dr. Brooke DeLauro is here this morning. They are talking on Thursday night, 6:30 at the Downtown Library, about France and specifically the Statue of Liberty with Craig. And Brooke will talk a lot about food. Food is such an interesting, when I saw that's what you were talking about, because that is one of the things when people talk about going to France, and that's what they always talk about. Or when someone comes back, where did you eat? What did you have? What did you like?
Right. And I think sometimes that question makes me cringe a little, I think, because people are looking for, I mean, I don't want to say the TikTok restaurants, because I don't even know if I know enough about that to even say that. But, you know, they're looking for something that's trending that they've seen online. And I often find that those are maybe not, I'm sure they're great meals, right? But I don't know if they're the best representations of French cuisine, right? There is haute cuisine, but equally important, so that sort of the elegant, fancy restaurants and things like that. But I think equally important is simple meals, right? So the French really value the idea, or put an emphasis on the importance of ingredients, right? So there's a strong philosophy that simple ingredients prepared well can make an extraordinary meal, right? So when you're going to these five-star Michelin restaurants, which of course is another thing that we've inherited from the French, so, you know, not to dismiss those, but, you know, I think you're missing out on a little bit of what the French appreciate about French food, which is just the everyday experience, lingering at the table, right? Craftsmanship, sort of pleasure, the joie de vivre, you know, the joy of living mentality that defines the French is certainly manifests itself at the table and in the eating experience. So I think checking off a list of some of the more well-known restaurants misses the point a little bit of what the French value about their food.
Interesting. Well, you mentioned lingering at the table. I mean, that's something we all should learn, can learn from, and would be better off if we did do more of that and didn't just rush through things.
Yeah, and it's challenging, right? So that I think, and it's the reason for which I believe the French waiters get a bad rap, right? That I mean, the French generally are thought to be rude, and that would be a whole nother hour-long conversation that we're not going to get into. But waiters, in particular, are thought to be rude because they don't check in on you. But they're not, you know, in the U.S. we're trying to flip tables and get people in and out quickly. And the waiter will, you know, sort of quote-unquote ignore you, but they think that you are there to enjoy the experience, to enjoy talking, the conviviality of the company you're with, and they're not going to interrupt you because they think that's disruptive to that experience. So you really have to flag them down. If you don't, you will never get a check. right? You could sit there for 3 hours and they will never, once they've delivered your food and the meal is finished, they will not bother you. I mean, you could sit for hours.
If I ever go to France, I want to go with you then, because you know those things.
And you need to know. It's a challenge when I'm there with students, because I sort of have to apologize to the waiter if we have like a theater performance to get to in the evening. Like, I know, I'm sorry, this is, I should not ask you for the check, but we have a schedule. Like, and I know I'll get the eye roll, like, you're supposed to be here enjoying this. You don't you should not have scheduled something afterwards. So
really it is, it is so much more, and just, I've learned just from both of you a whole bunch of stuff already this morning. But that the French food really is a way of expressing yourself, and
yes.
it's an expressive kind of thing, and it's not just about the food, even though it's really good.
Right. Exactly. I think it's you know, it expresses how they see themselves, and the idea that food is so deeply integrated into both the social network fabric of society. But also into the intellectual and artistic culture, right? So I had mentioned earlier that the French restaurant was where a lot of the restaurant brigades and kitchen hierarchy was born, and that was then distributed throughout the world. But restaurants and cafes have also always been significant social institutions, right? So the French cafe was historically a place where people drink coffee, but also exchange ideas. And as an example, Le Procope, which is the oldest continuously running cafe in Paris, I think it's like 1680-something as the founding date, was the place where the revolution was planned. So you had political thinkers, Robespierre and Danton and Marat all met there. It's still open today, right? And that's where they planned the revolution. So it has that artistic and social aspect to it as well. Intellectual exchange was important around food in the cafes. So those are all intertwined and all important to French society.
That's fascinating. It ties into Fredericksburg, just because we have the Rising Sun Tavern. You always hear about the Rising Sun Tavern and how things went, you know, were discussed there.
Yeah.
So no, this is fascinating. And there's you learn so much about a culture just this little bit. Sometimes you'll make assumptions of the French are this way or that way about things, and they're not at all. And it can be tied to something as simple as food.
So
we switching gears back to the Statue of Liberty, Craig. How did it get here? So how did it get from there to here?
Well, it was a long process, for one thing, and Bartholdi had to raise an awful lot of money, and he had to do it from many, many sources. But the idea originally had been that it would arrive in 1876 for the centennial.
Okay.
That was the plan. So he began working on this in the late 1860s, and it didn't in fact get here till 1883.
Okay.
It did not make it for the centennial at all. And one of the things that I'll show in the presentation is photographs of the statue in pieces, because it was, I think it was 300 pieces, something like that.
Wow. Oh, I didn't realize that
250
many. Okay.
Crates, you know, and I just love the photographs of what it looked like when it was being built. Like this one, for example, this is outside of his studio in Paris. That's the
look at the scaffolding and everything.
Yeah, that's the statue in downtown Paris while it was being built.
Oh, wow.
And so it was constructed in Paris, and then I assumed
it was constructed in Paris, and then it was taken apart and put into crates and put on a ship.
Oh, okay. So
and shipped to New York.
Okay.
And one of the other funny things about this is that you know, everybody knows who built the Eiffel Tower.
Right.
It's called the Eiffel Tower. Eiffel did the interior of this. He had not yet built the tower. The tower didn't come till 1889. But when he was already an engineer building bridges, and he built the interior, sort of the skeleton that the copper exterior was attached to. So that's completely separate, you know, from what you think of as the statue. You think of what you see, which is the exterior of it. But there's also the whole interior
scaffolding
inside that it's all attached to. It's funny, no one knows the name Bartholdi. Nobody knows who built the Statue of Liberty.
Right.
Everybody knows who built the Eiffel Tower. It's called the Eiffel Tower. But it's funny that Eiffel
had a
huge hand in building this.
I didn't know.
And we don't call it the Bartholdi statue. We call it the Statue of Liberty. Yeah. So nobody knows who built it. I think that's just an interesting fact too.
Yeah.
He's as unknown as any sculptor could be, and no American, I think, knows the name Frederick Bartholdi. But it took an awful lot of work, and then he had to raise money on the French side to build the statue. He had to raise money on the American side to find a place to put it. He had to find a place to put it. He picked the island himself when he came into New York. He looked around and he said, "I think." He first wanted to do it on Manhattan, but then he decided to do it in the harbor.
Yeah.
He found Bedloe Island, so he had to get the rights to Bedloe Island. He had to get the pedestal built. If you look at the Statue of Liberty, it's not just standing on the ground.
Yeah.
You know, it's on a pedestal that's about 100 feet tall.
Right.
I don't know. I'm not sure if that's it, but engineering that too, that had to be built. It's just an astonishing amount of work that went into it. And then to raise money, one of the things that they did, and these are where you find these photographs, he would exhibit like the torch in the hand. I think it was at the World's Fair in Paris. Mm-hmm. Just the torch in the hand is on display, and people can go into the torch and walk around it.
Right.
You know, but he would charge a little bit of money for people to do that, to raise money. The head was displayed in several different places in a similarly, you know, well in advance of it being put together in New York.
So we don't think about these things. We just look at it today and it's iconic. And of course we would want it. And of course, it was a gift from France. Yeah. Thank you. And
right.
we don't think of all of these, you know, the down and dirty kind of things that had to be done to get it here.
That's right. We take it completely for granted. It's as though it was a natural phenomenon or something. You know, we just take it for granted as part of the world. And the fact that it was a French gift. Again, we talked about the chaos of the French government. It wasn't a French gift in the sense in which you would think.
Totally.
The president said, let's do this as a way to show our appreciation.
Yeah.
You know, it was really, it came together in a completely different way. This book that I found on it called Liberty's Torch by Elizabeth Mitchell, it just was a wonderful, it's really about Bartholdi, but it's the sculptor, but it goes into all this detail, and it's got some wonderful photographs in it too of the statue in its early stages of construction.
Well, and we see pictures of it from a distance so often. It just reminded me when you held the book up, when up close, and I've not been to New York to see it, but you see pictures of it up close. Boy, it's just magnificent, and it's huge.
Yeah. Yeah. It's enormous. One of the stories about this was that he was holding dinners in the head, charging people, you know, celebrities, famous people, rich people, you know, to raise money. So when the head was on display the head was on the ground, you know, at the World's Fair or whatever, but they're having dinners inside the head.
Yeah.
You know, the connection to French food.
Right.
You know, lingering in the head.
Well, and you think that it's so big, it's so iconic, and you realize how impressive it was and has been as immigrants have come to this country to go in and see it.
But it was not originally associated with immigration either. It was
interesting.
That came because of Emma Lazarus's poem, The New Colossus, where she says, you know, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, your wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. That was, I don't think it was until the 1900s that poem was attached to the pedestal of the statue.
So it was there, for 30 years before?
Right. So it was really, the... Again, his original inspiration was the end of slavery. The Civil War ended in 1865. It was the end of slavery that made him want to do liberty. And similarly in Egypt, there was the enslavement of a certain class of women that he was trying to when he proposed the idea in Egypt. So that was the original idea, and so it morphed into being about immigration. And then there's some. It's interesting that a couple of years ago, back in 2019, when Cuccinelli was working in the first Trump administration, he tried to dissociate it from immigration. He actually proposed that it should read, "Give me your tired, your poor, who can stand on their own two feet and who will not become a public charge." That was
that sort of takes away some of the
he wanted the Trump administration wanted to dissociate it with immigration rather than America being welcoming to immigrants to not being welcoming to immigrants. If you can stand on your own two feet already,
come on in. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. And if you're European.
Well, this is why it's so important to have not only this lecture series, but you just think of just the sister city connections, and there's so much to be learned from other cultures, and we're so fortunate in this area. I mean, I just look at you two and you represent there are a lot of people who have similar interests, and we're really fortunate around here.
Yeah, I'll just mention the other speaker. We decided to do this. Our contribution would be to have three different speakers and talk about three different elements. Bill Beck will be our other speaker, and he's going to be talking about the influence of French philosophical ideas on the American idea of religious freedom.
Okay.
And that, too, extremely important. That's something that we take for granted today, the idea of religious diversity and pluralism. Mm-hmm. It's a worldwide principle now, but it was completely revolutionary in the 18th century. And the French philosophers like Voltaire and Montesquieu and even Rousseau, you know, they recognized when you only have one religion allowed, that's tyranny.
Yeah.
Because anybody who isn't of that religion is going to be oppressed. And I think it was Voltaire who said, if a society has only one religion, it leads to tyranny. If it has two, they cut each other's throats. But if it has 30, they can live in peace.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea was promote religious diversity, and that way you can have civil peace.
Yeah.
Because when you don't have religious diversity, you have oppression.
Thursday night at 6:30 at the Central Rappahannock Regional Library downtown is the cultural quilt series continues with France, and just you two talking this morning. I mean, you're going to walk away with just really a lot of good information, Craig. I totally have a different view of the Statue of Liberty, and again, and Brooke with yours I just look at food in a much different way. These are really informational kinds of series. In kinds of stuff that you both was it a lot? I mean, you both lived this kind of stuff. Was it a lot of work to put all this together?
Well, it wasn't too much work. I mean, I was interested. I wanted to know more about the Statue of Liberty.
Yeah.
I knew there was a backstory that there had to be a backstory, and so it was really fun what is work for me now is I've been retired for 5 years. I'm not used to preparing a class anymore. writing lectures
or getting up and talking on the radio at 8 in the morning.
Yeah, right. So that part of it, organizing it into a talk, has been work. But the reading up on it and so on, that was really interesting. That was a lot of fun.
I think perhaps similarly, obviously there's a lot that's sort of, having spent a lot of time in France, that you know to be true about French food, and I have taught a class on culture where I had the same struggle, but just trying to make it more academic, right? I could talk anecdotes all day long, but I wanted to research a little bit to have some background. So, everyone knows about the baguette. Actually, that's a great example. We were talking about the language question earlier, so and how it reflects culture. The word for chopsticks is baguettes, plural, and a magic wand is a magic baguette. And that only works in France, right? So anything long and thin, it takes the name baguette, effectively. And so that's
isn't the conductor's wand?
Also, yes. Yeah. Yes, also a baguette. Good call. and then just looking, so I learned, for example, that for the past 20 years, the city of Paris has awarded a prize for the best baguette, right? It's a fierce competition, and the winner of the competition gets to provide baguettes for the Élysée, for the president for the year. For the and that's the, you know, and of course it was lack of bread that led to the French Revolution, right? So just that the kind of, you know that it accompanies every meal, you know that you can't put it upside down on the table because that's bad luck, all these little things, but sort of what's some of the, you know, the real more research based things behind it.
It's so central to French life too. I mean, you go to the boulangerie and you pick up a baguette right before dinner, you know.
Yeah.
And you're eating part of it on the way home, and it's fresh. And,
right.
I mean, everybody does that two, three times a day. You go down, if you live there in the city, you go downstairs two or three times a day, and you go pick up a baguette.
Right. And even being there as short as a month, but certainly as short as, you know, a semester, as I've done, you know, you know the boulanger or boulanger, the person who owns the bakery, and they know you, and they ask things about your life, and, you know, even when you're a temporary visitor or a short-term visitor.
Yeah.
And that's always fun.
And there's the little ritual there, too. You walk in, they always say, "Bonjour, monsieur."
Yeah.
And then, "Monsieur, dame," they ask you what you want, and... The little dance kind of.
Exactly.
It's almost scripted. Every person who comes in is, "Bonjour, monsieur, bonjour." And then, "Monsieur, dame," they ask you what you want, and then you tell them what you want, and then, "Merci, monsieur."
Merci, au revoir.
Au revoir, monsieur, dame. And you go through that. And if you don't do that, you're being rude, and you obviously aren't properly raised.
You have to say hello. As soon as you walk into a space, if you see no one, it doesn't matter. Just say hello.
Right.
Dr. Brooke DeLauro, Dr. Craig Vasey here this morning. The Cultural Quilt Series on France, Thursday night, 6:30 at the Downtown Library. We'll wrap it up when we come back on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
This is Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Sponsored by Green Line Service Corp. Miss a part of the show? No problem. Just subscribe to the Town Talk podcast on your favorite podcast platform. And now, back to your host, Ted Schubel.
Good stuff this morning. The Cultural Quilt Series continues on Thursday night. It's France, the topic, beginning at 6:30 at the Downtown Library on Caroline Street. You guys have been great. Craig and Brooke here this morning to talk about it. And I could just listen to you guys talk French. I have no idea what you're saying. You could be talking about me, but I would think that sounds really good. Craig, go ahead.
One other thing I'll just mention is that this summer we again have French students coming in the Sister City Exchange program. So they will be here in July. I think it's 9 or 10 students. It's a smaller group this year, but they'll be staying. You know, we have home stays lined up for them to be here for a 2-week period. And this is the 46th year of the Sister City relationship with Fréjus. And this will be that means like the 22nd or 23rd time that we have had French students coming to Fredericksburg, and next year, as last year, American students will go to France.
In the Sister City Association, there are a number of different areas you can get involved with, and check it out, because you do all kinds of things during the year. Again, 6:30 on Thursday night, Dr. Craig Vasey and Dr. Brooke DeLauro will be giving their France talks about food and the Statue of Liberty. And thanks for coming in and sharing this, because this is going to be we're fortunate in this area, like I said, to be able to have these discussions. And Brooke, I know so much more about food now, and I just feel like I was so surfacey before. Yeah. And you've taught me, and you've also taught me about saying hello.
Yes.
Making sure you
must always say hello.
You always say hello.
Rule number one.
And the fact, Craig, that you learned French when you did, you were on a pedestal before. You're now on a Statue of Liberty kind of pedestal. Thank you both for coming in.
Thanks for having us. For
good stuff. 6:30 Thursday night, Central Rappahannock Regional Library, the Cultural Quilt Series on France. That's it. Thanks for listening. See you in the morning.
Thanks for listening to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA, sponsored by Greenline Service Corp. The views expressed by the host and guests on this program are their own and not necessarily those of this station, its management, or Centennial Broadcasting. Hear the show anytime by subscribing to the Town Talk podcast on your favorite streaming platform. The Glenn Beck Program is next on News Talk 1230 WFVA.